G'day, Groovers. Welcome to another instalment of The U Project. Tiffany Ann Cook over there at fucking TYP Central. Hello.
Good afternoon, Harps.
You all right?
I am good, thanks. How are you?
Well, I'm a little bit intimidated because I'm essentially insecure, and the bloke you got on's got fucking biggest arms I've ever seen. And I said to you, what's Kerwin like? And you said, he's like you, but better. And that was fucking hurtful. So I want to see, like, I want to talk.
What's this guy got?
I wasn't even talking about his arms either. They were just an added bonus.
Will you stop talking over each other, you two fucking amateurs? So I want to talk to this bloke who's me 2.0. Hey, mate, how are you?
I'm unstoppable, mate. How are you?
Yeah, I'm really good. Thanks for taking the time to talk to us on.
And the Tiffany fucking Cook, great to meet you, mate.
Yeah, she's a big fan of you. She loves you. She's doing your stuff right now. And I get a fucking download each day, Kerwin, this, Kerwin, nice. That. I'm like, fuck Kerwin. Let me meet him.
And now's your chance. Here we go.
Yeah. No, mate, you're going all right. You're clearly doing some great things. So well done and congratulations to you. But
thank you, brother.
Yeah, we appreciate you taking the time. So when you get, I got stuck with one of my mum's friends about a week, not stuck, caught chatting with one of my mum's friends about a week ago, and she goes to me, and she's 80, she goes, so what is it that you do? I thought, where do I start? Because I do 20 things, but they're all in a similar space. So when someone that doesn't know who you are catches up with you, bumps into you, gets introduced to you, and got no idea of the Kerwin Ray story, and they go, what do you do? What do you tell them?
I tell them I'm an ass model for Calvin Klein.
Yeah, you definitely are. Yeah, that's you, dude.
Tiffany, right. If I walked in backwards, Tiff, you would not be laughing as hard as what you are right now. You'd be like, oh, my God, yes. I thought that was Mark Wahlberg. Yeah. No, normally just say that to break the ice. But, I have to be honest, that's not a question I necessarily enjoy answering because I'm not someone that enjoys small talk. And so for me, if someone asks me that question, you know, I really assess the situation and the time that I've got. But the best way for me to describe myself is I'm just someone who is absolutely obsessed with performance. And that obsession kind of has a number of different focuses in terms of potential. I'm obsessed with business. I'm obsessed with, you know, the sales, the marketing, the leadership, the scaling aspects of that. And in, you know, in my situation, scaling what is to be considered an impossible business to scale. I'm obsessed with performance and flow state management and understanding and utilizing, you know, what are the best performance strategies, both, you know, neurological, physiological, psychological, that can be deployed, you know, whether you're a mum, a dad, an entrepreneur, or an elite professional athlete, or even spec ops, you know. And so for me, the easiest way for me to really answer that question is just I'm obsessed with performance, and I focus that into a couple of areas, specifically, you know, sport, military, parenting, and a big one for me is business.
From where did this curiosity around performance arise, Brother Kerwin?
Well, I was diagnosed at the age of 7 with ADHD and dyslexia. And so I was told I was learning disabled. And every 3 months between year 1 and year 12, I was reminded of just how stupid I was. And it was normally a bit of a rotation because I'd normally get told in front of the whole class, you know, what my grades were. Normally, and then my parents were separated, so I have to go home and then I'd have to share it with my mom, and then I have to go and take it to dad's the weekend I was with dad's and share it with dad. And so I had this constant reinforcement that I wasn't too bright. I never read a book until the age of 23. I was actually told at a young age that I was stupid, and I actually believed that, and I held on to that as a identity for a very long period of time. And so by virtue of that limitation, I started exploring my potential in the physical world. I became an athlete. Like, I started athletics when I was probably, I think, 4 or 5, you know, and by the time I was in late primary school, I was, you know, a regional competitor sprinter. I was very much into my athletics. And then as I grew older, I got more into, I guess you could say, other performance sports. Powerlifting was one of them. Bodybuilding was another. And, you know, the old joke is I could lift 100 before I could count that high. And I really learnt, and I guess you could say, by virtue of not thinking I was very bright for a period of time, how to, you know, extend the potential into other areas. Because I thought, well, if I'm not going to, you know, if I'm clearly not going to be ducksing the school, I may as well, my mind was I was going to become a professional athlete. because I didn't think I had the academic intelligence or any intelligence for that matter to be able to do anything else. And then one day I read a book and I actually remembered what was in it. And then before I knew, I started challenging. I literally remember the first book I read where I actually finished it. It was in, I was managing Elite Fitness at Carindale at the time. I was out the back and I finished this book by Dr. David Schwartz called The Magic of Thinking Big. And, you know, as I finished the last page, I remember thinking to myself, maybe I'm not stupid after all. And yeah. and that question really kind of spurred, you know, greater exploration into, you know, what I'd consider to be is an incredible journey over the last 47 years.
Isn't it interesting how not many people think about the way they think? They just think. And they get programmed from an early age, taught and trained and told and programmed to believe that they're stupid or they're incapable or their potential is limited. But when you do something like read a book and you understand the book and you remember the book and you start to apply some of the principles in the book and you start to get results, you kind of go, well, maybe that was bullshit what they were telling me.
Mm. And that was very much my experience. You know, I was really lucky because my old man, he was one of the top economists in the Southern Hemisphere. My mum was a clairvoyant and psychic who was quite entrepreneurial. So I got exposed to a lot of different contrast in life. But I, for the longest time, just didn't think I was very intelligent. You know, that in itself says everything, doesn't it?
that's hilarious. Well, you know what's interesting? Like, there's an area of research, you've heard the term, I'm sure, called metacognition, right? Which is thinking about thinking or understanding the way that we think and where that comes from. But, you know, I've listened to a bit of your stuff and you know, you don't need me to tell you this, but you're helping people think differently all the time and you're challenging self-limiting beliefs and, you know, bullshit stories and that hardwiring, that subconscious program that's been running, you know, in a bullshit fashion for 10 or 20 or 30 years. And it's, you know, you're teaching people how to reprogram themselves, not just professionally and behaviorally, but also cognitively and emotionally. You know, I don't know if that's your intention, but you're definitely doing it.
Oh, absolutely. Look, I'm someone who's had a lot of problems in a whole range of different areas, but I'm just someone who's obsessed with performance, but I'm also obsessed with documentation. I'm obsessed with process. I'm obsessed with routine and duplication. And, you know, I think that's what, you know, attracts me about business. But, you know, I think when I look at every single aspect of life that I talk about, and it's interesting because people say, man, you know, you talk about business, you talk about parenting, you know, you talk about addiction, you talk about mental health, you know, you talk about a whole range of different things. And they go, well, is there a strategy behind that? And I'm like, well, the only strategy is I talk about the stuff that I'm obsessed about. I talk about the stuff that I obsess on. And I only talk about the things where I've got some legitimate results in my own life. But yeah, you'd be 100% bang on. My goal isn't just to affect people. My goal is to, you know, essentially impart the routines and the processes that by virtue of them being deployed as a natural consequence, people change. And thinking is a big one, you know, because that's fundamentally the seedling of, you know, a lot of thought of behavior.
Well, our mind is kind of the operational HQ for life, really, isn't it? And I think the interesting thing is you probably meet people all the time that you think this person has got a fair bit of talent or potential, or you might think this person's a dickhead. But I've met a lot of people over the years where I go, wow, this person's got more talent and more ability and more potential than they know. And it's not their talent or potential or ability that gets in the way, but rather they're thinking about themselves.
Yeah.
You know, and so all some people need is for someone to go, you know what? I actually reckon you could be good at this, or a bit of encouragement, a bit of support, or somebody like you opening a new door to a different kind of approach to things.
I think what a lot of people are missing is a good metaphor to be able to see a relationship between something they already understand and something that they don't. And most people don't understand themselves. Like, we're not taught self-awareness in school. You know, we get much better walkthroughs on a fucking iPhone than we do on, you know, our own system of function. Like and this is my philosophy, Craig, and I'm not sure, as someone who's, you know, doing a PhD in neuroscience, you'll probably, you know, echo some of these sentiments. I am fundamentally I have an enormous level of belief that every single one of us is $1 trillion to biotechnology in a box. You're $1 trillion of biotech in the box. Tiff is $1 trillion of biotech in the box. If I could get you, replicate you, package you and put you on a shelf, that IP would be worth $1 trillion. When you look at the complex systems within the body, when you look at the complex systems within the brain, and you look at the programmable nature of our biology, it is a biotechnology. We are, as you said, we are fully programmable. And every single one of us have been programmed to think and as a result, ultimately behave in very specific ways. But we think that because we've been born that way or we grew up that way, we're fixed that way. You know, and in truth, once people start to realize, you know, the last, let's call it 80 years of computer science has been dedicated to trying to replicate what our brains do fucking naturally without any effort, without any, you know, programs whatsoever, you start to realize, well, hang on, maybe I am a $1 trillion piece of biotech, but no one actually showed me or gave me the user's manual on how to actually use this operating system. You know, because I am a piece of biotechnology, I do have a piece of hardware, I do have a massive storage potential in my brain, and I'm running different programs, you know, and some of us are running Word, some of us are running Excel, some of us run the whole program on the fucking desktop, and so our whole life moves very slowly, and other of us have learned how to, you know, have enormous amounts of programs behind us, and we access the shortcuts when it's required in order to deploy resources effectively and intelligently. And I think for most people, the biggest thing that's missing is a context. They don't see themselves in any other picture other than the one that they've seen themselves in, you know, for most of their life. And when you add a good analogy and you give people a different context, you go, I know for me, you know, I was addicted to drugs at age 19. And I was quite a functional addict, I like to say. But, you know, I wasn't robbing houses and, you know, stealing things in order to pay for my addiction. But I had a pretty fully fledged amphetamine addiction at the age of 19. I sorted my shit out. I got stuff together. I worked through my issues and I sorted it out. But then I still had this compulsive nature. And I was just like, well, I'm just an addict. And I was like, well, no, I'm not just an addict. I can't remember who said it to me when I said, maybe you're not an addict. Maybe you're just someone who's very resourceful. Maybe you're very good at just getting the outcome, but the outcome that you've trained yourself to get right now is high. And imagine if you could actually transition and create a new context for that potential. And, you know, because here was the thing. If I turned up at a mate's house and everyone was like, oh, no one's got any gear. I'm like, well, have you tried everybody? They're like, yeah. I was like, fuck, bullshit you have. Give me the phone. You know, I'd bang the phones. I'd door knock. And sure enough, 3 hours later, I'd be the guy going, see, told ya. And then we're like, oh, my God, you know, no one had any. It's like, well, I just don't give up. But you then take that and apply that context to business. You now have the foundations for a high grade professional entrepreneur, someone who is incredibly resourceful, who, you know, oh, there's no customers around. Are you kidding me? There's a phone book right there with fucking 30,000 names in it. Ring 1,000 people. There's a customer in there somewhere.
Yeah.
And when you've got that level of resourcefulness, or when you've got innate gifts and you can transfer the context of those gifts into other areas, that's powerful. And I just think everyone's got a gift, you know, but, you know, most people are being judged on their ability to climb a tree when their gift is to swim.
You know?
And much like Einstein says, if we judged a goldfish's intelligence by its capacity to climb a tree, we'd think all goldfish are, you know, are pretty stupid. Where in fact, goldfish have an average attention span of 7 seconds. Humans have an average attention span of about 3.5 seconds. So if we're not careful, goldfish will take over the world.
Yeah, I've heard that. In fact, I'm going to replace Tiff pretty soon with a guppy. So you just stand by, Tiff. You're exactly right. Interestingly, you and I have got a lot of similarities in our background. I started my first business at 19. Then I set up my first gyms at 26. You at 23. I read you're a bodybuilder from an old bodybuilder. I was a bodybuilder forever, but I also worked in as a director of health and wellness for an addiction treatment center, and worked with the boys and girls going through the trials and tribulations of addiction. And yeah, thank you. And they taught me more than I taught them, because I had no clues when I started, but that was a steep learning curve. But you know, the thing is that when an addict is looking to score, he or she is very, you know, resourceful and creative and focused,
determined and
committed, and like that, like you said,
they've
got a goal. They've got a goal in mind. They've got a task. They will figure out how to do that with unbelievable skill and energy. And you're like, wow. Now imagine if, as you said, if you could take some of those skills and that energy and that mindset and that strategic thinking and transfer that to business or health or relationships or lifestyle or whatever it is. You know, because a lot of those skills and those principles and strategies are fully transferable.
Totally, in every way, shape, and form.
Yeah.
You know, we are a puddle of intelligence that can be programmed.
Yeah.
And you know, addiction is a really interesting concept, because here's what I've learned: everyone's an addict. Addiction is a spectrum. you know, and that spectrum is often governed by how the brain develops. And you're probably fully aware of this, if you, especially if you're familiar with Gabor Mate's work. And, you know, the things that fundamentally have the greatest impact on our brain development is trauma. And it's not so much just the trauma, it's our ability to be able to regulate stress in traumatic situations. It's our ability to be able to regulate emotions in traumatic situations. So if you give a young developing brain lots of trauma with no skills, the brain maladapts and has a very different hormone profile. And so then the first time it has a substance that regulates that profile to what would be considered a normal range, they feel fucking normal, you know? And as a result, that becomes a compulsion of diminishing returns for a desire to feel normal. But when we understand everyone has the capacity to be resourceful, just like an addict, it comes down to finding the thing that you want to be committed to. And when you find that thing that you want to be committed to, then you have the, you find this incredible, you know, because I often say to people, people say to me, oh, come on, I've been trying to grow my business for some time now. I've been trying to change for some time now. I've been trying to do this for some time now. And I'll use the business one. Oh, I've been trying to make $1 million for at least like 5 or 6 years now. I just haven't been able to crack it. Have you done this? No. Have you done that? No. Have you done that? Why not? Well, I just really haven't found the time. I said, okay, have you got kids? Yes. Okay, so let's say I kidnapped your child tomorrow. And I took him away and I said, you've got 30 days to execute all of those things. And if you don't execute them, I'm going to start sending their body parts in the mail. No. You reckon you'd... Yeah, it's fucking like it's harsh. But guess what? Every single like, first of all, people get that shock of, oh my God, I can't believe you said that. Followed by, no, it's a serious question. Would you? And they're like, yes. And say, well, here's the thing. It's not that you can't do it. You just haven't found an overwhelming reason to be able to motivate yourself to engage the thought and the behaviors behind those thoughts in order to engage. And this to me is why one of the most important aspects of performance is understanding it's a self-awareness. To me, it's a self-awareness game. It's a game of self-awareness. And the more you know about the unit you are, the more you know about your values, the more you know about your stories, the more you can tune into, because to me, you know, there's a format to psychology, like there's a format to a hard drive. You know, you've got the coding system. That coding system then creates shortcuts, okay, in the form of beliefs. Beliefs become filters so that the brain can filter information strategically so it doesn't consume and, you know, produce large amounts of energy to be able to just function. So we filter things, you know, in order to be able to assess things very quickly. And then after a while, those beliefs become very solid in the form of values or motives. And that to me is one of the most important journeys that we need to get up, embark on as a human being, as a part of, you know, taking our control back or empowering ourselves, is, are we listening to the code that's going on? Okay, because if you're listening to the code, you're going to have a very, very keen interest and understanding of, oh, so that's why I believe the things that I do. Oh, and that's why these things are important to me. But this is the thing. And you probably know this yourself. Most people's values are already set by the age of 7 to 14. Yeah. Values are set. Values don't change. But for most people, money, as an example, doesn't fall into their top three values. How do we know this? Because whatever you value, you'll have plenty of. And if you value money, it'll come into your life easily and you'll have a lot of it around. But a lot of people don't value money, and so therefore it doesn't come in. And oftentimes people will see certain values, like they might think they value money, but that value of money is in conflict of a higher value, which might be the value of family. Yeah. And so if you have the value of family, but you want to become an entrepreneur and become free and make money. But if you come from a background and a childhood where your parents perhaps divorced, or I don't know about you, but you know, I grew up believing money is the root of all
evil.
Money doesn't grow on trees. I watched thousands of cartoons where the wealthy person was, you know, he wasn't the good guy. He was the fucking evil guy that ate children. You know, I've had overheard hundreds if not thousands of arguments in my home about, we can't afford that. What do you think I'm made of money? And financial disputes. You know, I had to watch my parents go through a financial dispute when they went through a separation. And so most of us grow up, you know, and then you get to the age where you can read the newspapers and you start reading headlines like, oh, the Australian Tax Office targets Australia's most wealthy in a tax blitz. It's like, well, why the fuck would you want to be wealthy?
Yeah.
Unconsciously, we go, consciously, we're like, well, I need money to survive. But unconsciously, we're fighting this ideal of what money looks like as a massive disruptor when it comes to the things that are generally important to us.
Mm.
And people often wonder why they sabotage their pursuit of money, you know, because oftentimes it's not so much a value as it is an anti-value based on how they've been programmed. And what we've got to do is, you know, essentially take a level of control and focus and be able to link the motives to things that are genuinely important and start producing evidence for the brain to create new connections around how that behavior won't actually take things away. It will actually provide things for. And then before we know it, you know, we're able to program our behavior a lot easily other than just thinking a certain way.
I love it. It's so interesting that everyone has a story about money. It's like everyone has a story about their body. Everyone has a story about food.
Yeah.
Everyone has a relationship with money, a relationship with food, you know, a relationship with their appearance.
relationships with stress,
yeah,
relationships with failure,
yeah,
relationships yeah. with trauma.
I'd love your school teachers from 40 years ago to hear the bloody learning disabled bloke.
Fucking, I know, right?
Hey, all you teachers, all you people who put this man in a pigeonhole of stupidity. Fucking hell, you got it wrong, well, champs. But anyway,
my year
mate, it's great. I love listening to you talk, and it's
thank you.
It's brilliant, and there's a lot of wisdom and there's a lot of insight. But you know what you did, I think? I've got a few mates of mine who grew up, you know, in the same pigeonhole or similar pigeonhole to you, where they were kind of, you know, labelled and judged and almost discarded. But both of them, these two dudes, they both became very resourceful and creative, and they created their – they're both successful. They both created their own language and operating system and their own style of learning, which was completely fucking ingenious, where they just learned to navigate so many different components of the human experience through sheer willpower and creativity, where they would figure out, you know, how to do exams and how to have conversations and how to do interviews and all of these things, where they couldn't really read well and they couldn't really comprehend certain things. But they, it's almost like they developed an extra sense that normal people, in inverted commas, don't have. You know, so I see that in you. I was going to say to you, I have a similar story about the one where you talk about kidnapping the kids, and mine is same story, different kind of model though, or different kind of focus, where I say to somebody, I say to the audience, you know, put up your hand if there's a, you know, a habit or something that you just, you know, you should stop, you can't deal with, or you've tried. And, you know, often it'll be something like the one thing that you can't give up. It's often chocolate or something like that. And someone will say to me, I can go to the gym, I can eat well, I can drink really moderately, my lifestyle is good, but I just can't stop eating chocolate. And I go, well, you can stop eating chocolate. You can stop right now, but you don't want to eat. You don't want to stop. And they go, no, I do. I go, well, you can. So the question is not how do I, the question is why won't I? And I remember I did a gig in Geelong and I had about 300 people at, I forget the name of that joint down there. But anyway, I had this conversation in real time in front of the audience with a lady, and we were having this kind of pseudo debate, tongue in cheek, a bit of fun. It was all good. And, she said to me, you know, I can't. And I said, do you have any pets? She goes, I have a dog. I go, how much do you love your dog? She goes, I love my dog more than my kids. And I go, so what happens if the next time, let's say in some alternate reality, if for any time in the next 12 months you eat a piece of chocolate and the dog just 5 minutes later, because you ate the chocolate, how much chocolate are you eating? And she says, well, of course I wouldn't eat chocolate then. You know, and it's the same thing. I go, well, clearly, and I know that's what we're demonstrating, is you actually have the ability to change your operating system in the moment. Of course, it's difficult. Of course, it's not likely. Of course, very few people do it. But can I change my behavior today? Yes. Can I change my subconscious programming today? No. But can I change what I do? Yes. And I think that's the difference for people. And also, and I'll shut up after this because it's your interview, but you know, the thing is that a lot of the shit we need to do, mate, is just hard, and people don't like hard.
Well, it's not that people don't like hard. People haven't been trained to do hard things, because this is where we start looking at the origins of, you know, what is the ultimate mindset? You know, and Angela Duckworth Smith identified that there's two types of mindset. You've got the fixed mindset, where those people believe that, you know, talent and skills are innate. There's only so much potential that I have. You know, I'm basically at the my prime in any one moment that I'm aware of. And then you've got the growth mindset. And the growth mindset is one that is adaptable. It believes that skills can be learned. It thinks it believes that problems can be solved. And when you look at those two brains under an fMRI, the fixed brain set, the fixed mindset, when it's been given a challenge, there's fucking nothing. Like, it's like the lights are out, because the brain literally believes that it can't solve the problem, and so it doesn't even try. Then you apply the same problem to someone who's got a growth mindset, put them on an fMRI, and it looks like New Year's Eve. That party is lighting up, and there's a whole bunch of, you know, people that are partying inside their head because they're looking for answers because they believe it can be found. But here's what we also understand. The correlation with grit or resilience sits in the growth mindset. Because here's what we know about growth. Growth is painful. Growth is hard. Growth is challenging. But there are many layers to growth. But more importantly, there are many layers to grit. And grit is the magic ingredient. You know, it's the magic ingredient behind Spec Ops. You know, if you look at the Navy SEALs and their ability to be able to complete, you know, the 6 weeks of BUD training and the last 5 days of Hell Week where they get 20 minutes of sleep, the only thing that prevents, you know, anything that the US government has been able to identify as the number one factor for them not tapping out is they have this thing called grit. They have this thing called resilience. But what is grit? Grit is the ability to endure things that are uncomfortable. Grit and resilience is the ability to endure and do things that are actually difficult. But here's what we know about grit. Grit can be learned, but it can't be learned in a fixed mindset. It can only be learned in a growth mindset. So there's a specific mindset that's required in order to be able to do hard things in the first place. And I'm not saying people can't convert, they can. But if they're trying to build resilience with a belief system that prevents them from thinking that they can solve problems, then they're already behind the fucking eight ball. There's got to be a shift in psychology. Once there's a shift in psychology, when we start going, well, maybe I'm not stupid after all. You know, maybe I can actually solve problems. Mm. We start thinking differently. We start trying to process information, but we start doing hard things. And doing hard things, it's like when you go to the gym. You guys know this better than anyone. You know, when you first go to the gym, you'll be flat out maybe curling 5 to 10 kilos. And you'll curl 5 to 10 kilos, you'll maybe get 8 reps, and you're like, ah, my arms feel like they're going to burn, you know, and we put the bar down and we go away and we have a bit of a rest. Okay, but most people, when they try and do hard things, they either get to the burn, they're like, oh my God, my arms are burning. There's something wrong. This is not normal. And they go, this is just bad. And so they bail. And that's why most people don't do the hard work around addiction or around trauma, because that shit's hard. That shit's difficult. That's confronting. When you have to start and getting deep into your darkness and into your traumas. But the same is true with lifting weights. It's hard. It hurts. But here's what we know. You're not supposed to do the work ongoing. You're supposed to do the work to the point of failure. Then you stop and you rest and you catch your breath. You do 3 or 4 sets and then you move on to a different muscle part. And I think the challenge for most people is they never actually build a resilience because they get used to not doing things that are hard. We live in a very entitled society where people are just handed things. You know, everything we want is literally, I don't even have to open my phone. Hey, Siri, what's grit? Hey, Siri, what's grit? I don't even need to Google. And now she's telling me what grit is. I don't even need to use my fingers. Mm. Everything given to me. Mm. You know, and unfortunately, you know, we live in a society where information is so freely available that most people haven't learned how to work hard. Most people haven't learned how to do hard things. And doing hard things is an exercise in resilience. And the more hard things we do, the more hard things we can do, and the harder the things we are able to do. And so it's a process of building up a level of strength. You know, I would call it, you know, when we look at the layers of grit, and I don't know if you've seen Stephen Kotler's latest book on The Art of Impossible, where he goes through the 6 layers of grit. I've now added another, I'm down to like 13 layers. I've just disseminated that book and that's given me all sorts of understanding. But, you know, one of the areas of grit that he talks about is the grit to persevere. You know, having the grit to persevere when things are hard, because doing hard things is hard, but doing hard things creates hardy people, not hardened people, hardy people. You know, and I think, you know, half of the work that's required for people, whether it's they're trying to be a better parent, they're trying to lose fucking weight, they're trying to do anything, most people don't do it because it's hard and they're just not trained to do difficult things.
There's somebody on this call right now who's looking like the cat that got the cream because she interviewed Stephen Kotler last week.
Oh, nice work.
And I'm now reading The Art of Impossible and it's brilliant.
Fucking game-changing book. I've listened to the audio about 4 or 5 times now. You know, I can't wait to get my hands on the book so I can actually start reading it. I've already disseminated and pulled it apart. It's a great user's manual. And Steve's a great guy. He's a good mate of mine. He's become a good friend over the last couple of years through a range of interviews. But here's what we know. The formula's out there. You know, you don't even have to sit there and go, well, how do I become gritty? Just read a fucking book. Mm. You know, oh, it's a bit difficult. Listen to a fucking audio then. You know, but most people, they just would rather put it in the too hard basket so they don't try. You know, and that's where I look at my son. You know, and he's the future. He really is. And by the future, I mean all kids are the future. But I'm constantly engaging him to do things that are difficult. Mm. I'm constantly pushing him. So he knows how to do things that are hard. He's incredibly resilient. He's very gritty. You know, a couple of weeks ago, he stood on a fucking jumping ant's nest and he came home and his foot was swollen to about 3 times the size of his other foot. But he's so used to performing, you know, under when he's at his worst that he didn't even slow him down. He cried. Actually, I don't even think he cried. I think he cried maybe for half an hour that night because he couldn't sleep. But apart from that, he just ran around with a giant swollen sausage foot because he's used to doing things that are hard, you know. And this is where we learn it. We learn this as kids. Are our parents giving us opportunities to do difficult things, or are they helicopter parents that are making our lives as easy as possible? And again, it's not about making hard kids. It's about making hardy kids. And part of that process is getting them to engage in academic, psychological, physiological, sporting, you know, activities that stretches them to do things that are difficult. And then they learn, oh, maybe I can do this. Oh, maybe I can do that. And then before you know it, you've got an obsessed little seven-year-old who thinks he can do fucking anything.
He's 7 years old. I thought he was 22.
Oh, hey, seven going on, 22 for sure.
Mate, how much of your insight and understanding and awareness has come through experiential learning, just doing lots of shit, and how much has been learned through the wisdom of others or standing on the shoulders of giants, as they say? How much has just been through doing the work, and how much through the
others? I'd say 90-10 or 95-5. Look, I'm a very experiential person. You know, when I discovered that there was only two fundamental beliefs, the fear of loud noises and the fear of falling, I went and did 200 skydives in the next 12 months. I went and trained with the Ukrainian Special Forces and the Navy SEALs, not to run through puddles and muds, but to play with explosives and guns, because every time a loud noise goes off, it would trigger your autonomic nervous system. And the more you get used to it is by having that activated consistently whilst engaging in process-orientated work, to the point where you can have guns and bombs and things going off around you. You can be thrown out of an airplane and you can maintain a complete sense of equilibrium. And so for me, I'm very fortunate because I've you know, my parents separated when I was 6 months old. You know, my mum went to remarry when I was 8. The guy she went to remarry was murdered. At the age of 15, I nearly died. I fell on a broken bottle, cut my nerves, cut my arteries, main tendons, you know, 2 blood transfusions, 13 and a half hours of microsurgery. I was told I was going to be disabled, almost died. You know, I then get into security. I've been shot at. I've been stabbed. I've had guns put in my mouth. I've got literally 12 tapestries of scars across my face from bottles being smashed, glasses being smashed, you know, 4B2s with, I've got a chunk of my skull that is no longer there from a 4B2 that I was hit that had a nail sticking out of it. You know, I have been in car accidents, motorbike accidents, skydiving accidents. I've experienced so much trauma, a disproportionate amount of psychological, physical, and I'd even go as far as saying spiritual trauma that put me in a place where I literally had no choice. Oh, these are going to be a fucked up unit for life, or I had to do an enormous amount of work to get myself right. And I have just continually done an enormous amount of work to get myself right. And every time I do the work, I go, fuck, you know what? I reckon someone else would benefit from this. What did I do? How did I go through this? What was my process? Mm-hmm. And so if you look at most of my work, especially around the performance content, you know, is it original? No. You know, I read Stephen Kotler's book and I was just going, oh, I do that. 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 Oh, he's just put it in a book, but I'm already doing that. You know what I mean? I have to work that shit out for myself.
Yeah.
No one put it in a book for me to discover those things. And so I think that's part of I think that's part of my appeal. I think that's why people will listen to me on when it comes to my parenting content, because I am a dad, you know, and I'm an obsessive dad. I think that's why people will listen to me around conversations of trauma, because I have, you know, I did have complex PTSD, which was wrapped up in a dozen or so different, you know, severe violent traumas. You know, people will listen to me around ADHD and dyslexia because I've enjoyed those conditions. People will listen to me around addiction because I've had that experience. People will listen to me around relationships because I've had plenty and I've been through a divorce. And I'm willing to share my experience. You know, there's nothing worse than a teacher who teaches from a book. And I don't have any books. I've got 1,200 that I've read, and I'm very grateful for that knowledge. But when I teach, I'm teaching about life. And if you look at the results that we get with our clients, and I only just had this conversation earlier today, you know, someone said to me, how come your clients get such good results? Because we work with clients in the business capacity that are from startup to 300 mil. And when we work with clients over a longer period of time, it's about 1 in 3 will 2x to 10x in their first 18 months. And so whether, you know, if you're a $1 million business, we're talking a $10 million growth. A $10 million business, you know, 50, we create massive exponential growth and explosions in scale and growth. And people say, what do you do differently? And I'm like, well, first of all of our processes are world-class around the areas of planning, around the areas of marketing, around the areas of sales, leadership, cultural development, okay, and automation. But the thing that makes the difference, I do a disproportionate amount of work on mental, physical, spiritual, and emotional, because we're human. And we're 360 degrees. Business is 60 degrees of life. You know, there's another, you know, 300 degrees that most people are missing. And if you've got trauma in your relationship, or if you've got trauma in your childhood and you're trying to perform at a high level as an entrepreneur or as an athlete, but you're still holding on to that baggage, at some point your expression's going to experience the levels of dysfunction. Okay, or you're going to be weighted down by something psychologically, and it's going to affect some pattern of training or sleep that's going to prevent you from performing at a high level. One of the things I get business owners to do is I get them to work on their shit. I get them to do the hard work. I get them to work on their mental. I get them to work on their emotional. I get them to work on their trauma. I get them to work on their relationships, their addictions, you know. And then what happens when people get right and you give people good processes? They fucking fly. Why? Because we're designed to live in flow. We're designed to perform at a higher level. But we put shit in our head. We put shit in our mouth. We put shit up our nose, shit into our bodies. And as a result, we wonder why we perform like shit. You know, and when you take and you can detox, you know, every aspect of your life from a functional perspective and start realizing and detoxing the dysfunctional aspects of life, because we all have it. The only way I learned how to be, you know, have functional relationships is because I had dysfunctional relationships most of my life. You know, the only reason I've learned how to have functional levels of health, I've nearly died 7 times, you know, and of those 7 times, 3 of them have been from medical issues. You know, I had a stroke at the age of 34, you know, so I feel very blessed. And the only reason I can talk about, you know, health and fitness is because I've been, you know, right now I'm very grateful. I'm in, you know, I'm in the prime of my life. But, you know, going back even just 2.5, 3 years ago, if you look at the early days of me on the social experiment, I was fat. You know, I was 100 kilos, 102 kilos, roly-poly, roll me in the flour to find my wet spot fat. Like, I was fat, you know, and people saw that transformation. And so as a result, oh, maybe he's got something to share when it comes to health. They didn't know I'd been a fucking Australian champion bodybuilder and powerlifter. They just thought, oh, he's just had a midlife transformation. No, I was very lucky. I had the basis of a very solid unit underneath. I just let the weeds grow on top. Mm. And so everything I do comes from a point I can't. And it's interesting. I forgot about this. I got out of the speaking industry in 2003 for about 2 years because I'd been in the industry for about 3 years. I'd grown a number of businesses by leveraging the industry. I'd been exposed to some of the top speakers in the country and the world. And I saw behind the scenes and I went, this is a fucking charade. You know, 90% of the speakers who are walking around this on this planet Earth are literally fucking actors reading a script. And I was like, this is bullshit. I'm fucking out. You guys can take this and you can stick it in Pandora's box, because I don't want to be anything a part of this, because I'd become dysfunctional. After 3 years of being exposed in this industry, I'd started to become a bit of a chameleon myself, and I started realizing that I wasn't presenting an authentic self on stage. I was presenting a self on stage that would be most well received to increase the opportunity for transactional relationships. And then I, by virtue of fall out and follow through and break through, I got out of the industry, got some perspective. I was like, fuck that. That industry is a sick space. And then sure enough, I took 2 years off. And after 2 years, I was like, okay, what do I want to do? What would I love to do? And I kept going, I want to speak. I'm like, no, I don't want to do that. I don't want to do that. It's where the full of shit people live. But that's this is what you're here to do, Kerwin. You're here to be a teacher. You're here to share your experience. You're here to share your wisdom. You're here to share your knowledge. You're here to share your genius. You're here to share your experience. You're here to teach. And I was in this fucking turmoil for 6 months of like, I'm not going to do it. I don't want to be like the industry. And then I came to a conclusion while sitting on Bungan Beach in the Northern Beaches with my cat. My cat was like a dog. It's this fucking leopard of a dog. It's a Bengal. He's like literally like he could literally eat small chihuahuas. He's that kind of a cat. And he used to go for walks on the beach with me, and he used to sit on my beach chair with me. And I was sitting on the beach chair. I had a yellow notepad and I was just writing down ideas. And I made an agreement with myself. Okay, if you want to get back into teaching, it's going to be a 95-5 principle. 95% of what you talk about, you can only talk about from direct experience. And I'll give myself 5% leeway to talk about things that I haven't done, but I can only talk about the things that I haven't done if I'm committed to actually doing something. And so I was like, okay, 95-5. 95% of everything I say comes from direct experience and wisdom. The other 5% are things that I'm flirting with, but I'll always give the context. I'm not doing this right now. Here's something I'm flirting with or I'm learning right now. But I don't know. For me as a teacher, I find it really difficult to find alignment and passion. And I'm a pretty, you know, juicy kind of guy when it comes to my passion. And I can't get juiced up unless I've got an experience with something. And so that's where, for me, my technologies and what I share, 95% would be direct experience.
Yeah, you need to fire up a bit, bro. You're just lacking passion. I think that's your thing. You need, I think you need to have a crack. You're just fucking, you're just, you know, phoning it in. Come on, have a go. Nuts. You look, here's the thing, right? You're believable and you're real and you're raw, and you know, there's no script. There's, I always say, for you and I have a lot of similar philosophies, but I differentiate between the person, the actual person, and the persona. And what you see on stage a lot with people is a persona. It's not really them. It's them playing a role, or you know, acting, or, you know, one of the things that I did a gig the other night, and the lady said, where do you want to put your notes? And I said, I don't have any notes. And
I don't have any notes.
Do you have a power? Where's your power? I don't have a PowerPoint. And I always say, look, it depends what it is, but for the most part, I don't prepare hardly anything, depending on who it is and what it is I'm talking about. But I go, because I haven't met them yet. How can I plan a conversation with someone I haven't met yet? So even if it's, you know, 10 blokes or 10 women in a boardroom, or 1,000 people in a room, or whatever it is, you know, at 57, after, you know, 3 decades of speaking to audiences, I should be okay at it, and I should not have to write down, you know, 27 dot points, and I shouldn't need to refer to notes. And I just feel that you create a much more authentic experience where I involve the audience from the start. It depends, of course, if you're doing some workshop that's got a degree of formula and strategy to it, it's different, I know, but for keynotes. But I think, you know, what people must love about you, and what I like about you, is that they see themselves in you, because you're normal.
Yes, I'm real.
You're just a fucking dude, and you're probably sometimes...
That's the most common piece of feedback I get, Craig, is, you know what, you're just like me. Yeah. You're just like one of my mates. You're just like Greg. You're just like Craig, you know, and that's the thing. I think I have a point of relativity.
Yeah. I mean, when I tell people that, you know, we talk about whatever fear and insecurity and self-doubt and self-loathing and feeling like a fraud, and people go, yeah, I go, yeah, me too. It's all right. I've felt like a fraud my whole life. I've done lots of great shit, and I've had some success, and I still feel like I shouldn't be doing. I still feel regularly like someone's going to walk in and say, the gig's up, you know, give us the dough back, or give us the whatever back, or whatever it is. I know that's not going to happen, but you know, that feeling of being a fraud or not good enough, or that disposition for overthinking, that's probably, for a lot of people, that's always going to be kind of there. But it can also coexist with the knowledge, the intellect that, no, I'm actually quite good at this because I've done it a lot and I'm okay. You know, so that the emotion and the logic can kind of sit side by side, I think.
Look, I think there's a lot to be said for evidence. And I think some people have plenty of evidence that they ignore. Others have plenty of evidence that they dismiss. And, you know, some also have evidence that they minimize or even maximize.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, the truth is the result at the end of the day, you know, because people often, you know, I live in Byron Bay now. And so, you know, I mix with some interesting types. And, you know, the other day I was sitting down with someone who says to me, oh, well, how much plant medicine have you done? And I've, oh, yeah, I've done a few sits with, you know, with Ayer and a few other medicines. And they're like, oh, well, you know, I sit at least every 3 months, and I'll sit 5 times back to back. Or, you know, I've sat, and one guy picked up, because, well, I've sat with ayahuasca over 60 times in the last 7 years or something like that. And I literally said to him, so what does that look like? And they're like, well, what do you mean? I said, how does that translate in the real world? Like, it's all well and good that you're sitting in a fucking teepee, you know, drinking psychedelics and getting, you know, off your scone in order to heal. But for what purpose? How are you now taking what you've done and integrating that into your own life to produce something other than what, you know, what I'm seeing right now, which might appear to be questionable? Because if I wanted to do 60 sits of ayahuasca to look and to have your life, I don't think you're doing a great job selling it right now, you know? And so for me, whatever we do, there's evidence. Mm. And that's the truth. And your life is the truth, you know? And whether you're meditating for 20 minutes a day or for 20 hours a day, your life will tell the truth.
You mentioned before spirituality. Yes. Is that a component of your existence?
big time. I'm a spiritual gangster in many. Oh no, I have spiritual gangsters.
Well, your mum was a clairvoyant.
Mum was a clairvoyant psychic. I got told I had the gift at a very early age, and so you know, I'm blessed as someone who gets a lot of visions, a lot more now than I've ever had in my entire life. I'm someone who's blessed with an incredible sense of guidance and intuition. And I'm very grateful to the roots that my mum, you know, because I was born into Catholicism. We then converted to Mahakari, which is like a cult. We then converted to born again Christianity. And I'm talking the faith healings and the foaming at the mouth and the devil be gone. It's like I got to see it all. And we then converted to Buddhism. And so I've been through, you know, pretty well four relatively well organized religions to be exposed to dogma, scripture, philosophy, and I'm very grateful, but I'm no longer religious. I'm just confused. And I say that really more as a joke because it just plays well. But the truth is I've received an enormous amount from every faith that I've been involved in, you know, values, rituals. You know, to me, meditation is a form of prayer, you know. You know, prayer is a form of intention setting, you know. So I'm very grateful for the values that I've received and for the value that's been given and the alternative perspective that it's given me. But I'm no longer religious. I believe that there is a source. There's a source of consciousness. There's a source of intelligence. And I got introduced to that source when I had my stroke. Like I literally had what's referred to, when you'd be familiar with in your research, an NDE, a near-death experience. And part of my stroke, I literally was taken to a place that was very dark. And every single question that I asked, I got given the answer. And I ask big fucking questions. You know, why are we here? What's the meaning of life? What is the purpose of humanity? And I was boom, 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 boom. And, you know, it took probably 12 months for me to recall everything that was given to me, maybe even longer. But over a period of time, that stuff came out of me. And as I shared it, it was validated, you know, in my own investigations into not just philosophy, but also a lot of stuff that was given to me was around quantum mechanics and particle physics to create points of understanding between how certain processes take place and how they can be explained to people who don't understand, you know, what could be considered in some respects esoteric concepts like manifestation, you know. But most people don't question manifestation if they turn on a condenser in their room and then all of a sudden they pull out 12 liters of water. You know, from that room, they go, oh, look, I manifested 12 liters of water from a room that didn't have any water in it, you know, at the beginning of this morning. But there are many processes within, you know, within nature, you know, the law of thermodynamics, energy conservation. Energy isn't created or destroyed. It's just constantly changing form. That in itself is a great wrap for, you know, energy is constantly being recycled. And as humans, you know, we seem to have an inherent ability to be able to judge how things are created or think we know how things are created versus understanding that there's a little bit more, you know, magic at play here. And even Ed Witten, who, you know, he's the author, or I should say the author of M theory, which is probably the greatest unified theory that we've found to date. He's probably the equivalent of a 3x Einstein. And when you look at his unified theories around, you know, unifying all theories, he calls it M theory. And when you ask him, what's the M for? He goes, well, funnily enough, there's a little bit of magic in this because there's a lot of stuff that, you know, just we may not understand it, but it is very magical in nature. And, you know, when you understand particle physics and how, you know, subatomic particles behave, you start to believe that there is a magic in everything. Because that's the basis of all creation. The Newtonian world is born from the quantum world, and the quantum world, the Newtonian world is very predictable, very boring, very causal, very effectual. The quantum world, random, chaotic. It's not based on cause and effect. It's based on probability factors. And you know, understanding that anything is possible if there's enough probabilities weighting that potential. And all you've got to understand is we're the conduit. You know, we sit in between the quantum and the Newtonian space with this thing called a soul, where we have the ability to direct energy in a way where it can manifest in a whole range of different forms. But our psychologies often require a level of story to understand or comprehend or contextualize, which is probably the biggest thing that gets in the way of people being able to create the lives of their wildest dreams.
All right, you're definitely coming to my next dinner party because there's just so much I need to talk to you about. Now, mate, we could bang on forever. I'm sitting here captivated like a fucking six-year-old looking up at Santa. Yeah, wow. Well, we appreciate you coming on the show. I would love to chat longer, but we probably need to wrap it up for your benefit, but I'd love to talk to you another day. But thanks for sharing. Thanks for telling us your stories or some of your stories. Thanks for the encouragement to everybody. And how do people find you? I know that they can find you easily, but plug all the stuff you want to plug, mate, if you would.
Yeah, look, you can find me on all the social channels. Facebook, we're very heavy. Instagram, heavy. LinkedIn, YouTube, TikTok. We have a couple of offerings for the general market. We have Power to Create, which is a performance program that anyone can attend. Whether you, it's just the user's manual. You know, we're a $1 trillion piece of hardware, but no one actually gave us. I don't know if you remember. You're probably old enough to remember this, mate. Do you remember the Greatest American Hero?
Of course I do. Like the worst.
Believe it or not, I'm walking on it. And I love that because that's the greatest metaphor for what I do. Because you know, this is for those of you who aren't familiar. This is a guy that where the season, the pilot starts. He's driving through. You know, I think the Mojave Desert or the Las Vegas Desert, and a UFO flies over him. His car breaks down. He gets beamed up into a spaceship, and they give him a superhuman Superman suit with a box of instructions, and then they beam him back down to Earth. And as he's walking back to his car, the instructions fall out of the fucking the briefcase where his super suit is. And he gets home, he puts his suit on. He's like, "Well, how does this thing fucking work?" And he's like, "I saw Superman do this or this." And then before you know it, he does the right move, and he goes flying through his roof, smashing into cars, billboards, just banging things up. And the whole series is about him learning how to use this superhuman power. And that's what Power to Create is to me. It's like we've been given superhuman potential. We've been given $1 trillion of biotechnology, but no one gave you the fucking user's manual. I've got one, you know, that can be applied to any area or aspect of life, sporting, business, military, parenting, you know, fucking macrame if you want to. The other offerings that I've got are more in the business space. We've got the Accelerator, which is a 5-day training that we offer on social media. Nail It and Scale It, which is our flagship. It's probably one of the most immersive, intensive 3-day execution programs anywhere in the world. And then we've got K2 Elite, which is where we work with people for anywhere between 1 to 10 years, and we blow the shit out of their businesses. And KerwinRay.com.
You're a shy little thing. Once you get over that, those inhibitions, I want you to work on that social phobia you've got. Just keep.
Oh, I am. Just as an interesting, like I'm. People would know this. You might have picked it up. I'm ambivert, so I am. I experience not so much. I've developed a level of social grip, but for the most part, I am socially dysfunctional. I find it more comfortable to do an interview like this than I do to talk to two people, you know, at a dinner party. I'd rather speak to 10,000 people for 3 hours than two people I don't know on a street corner. It's a very interesting phenomenon. I am quite shy. And I know you find that you're laughing, but I am, you ask my partner, she'll go, he is when he's by himself and when there's no one around, you know, when there's no attention on me, my wave particle is very, very shy.
Mate, you actually don't know how much we have in common. I feel like in some ways, and people would go, no way, you're probably on some levels an introvert. I am actually, people think I'm an extrovert because of what I do.
Yep.
And I can do this. I can talk to like you. I can talk to a bunch of people. I can do radio. I can do podcasts. I can do all that stuff. But if I go somewhere, whatever, an event, and it's I'm not speaking, I'm just there, I'm happy to be there, but I don't want anyone to notice. Like, yes, I would rather just listen. If I'm standing with 10 people talking, I don't want to be talking. I want to be listening. You know, exactly. And the other funny thing is Catholic, then became just like you. Thank you, Jesus. Rafter swinging, tambourine banging. If loving the Lord's wrong, I don't want to be raped Christian. So there's a lot of overlap and similarity with our journeys, I think.
Nice. Well, I enjoyed this conversation.
Yeah, me too, mate. Thank you so much for your time. Look after you and keep doing amazing stuff, and we'll point everyone in your direction.
Appreciate it. And hopefully we can do another podcast again soon.
Love to. Thanks, Kerwin.
Thanks, guys. Thanks, Craig. Thanks, Tiff.
Thanks, Kerwin.